Good morning. A young almana was busy, was cleaning her house for Pesach. It was late one night. You can imagine, it was first yontif without her husband. It was quiet, very difficult emotionally. And she was cleaning behind the oven, so she was struggling. She pulled the oven out to clean behind it, no one to help her. So she pulls it out, and she notices an envelope had fallen behind the oven. She picks it up, she starts reading, she sees it's a note in her husband's handwriting. And she sees that the note was addressed to her. It said, "Dear Chanula, I know when you read this letter, I'll no longer be with you. And this will be your first Pesach without me, and I know how difficult it'll be. I want you to go buy yourself something special for Yontif to cheer yourself up." And in the envelope was $5,000 in cash. So she was very touched. The next day, she was telling her brother about a beautiful story, what had happened. And the brother said, I heard the story, said it's a beautiful, it was really, really beautiful and thoughtful. But you have to think about this for a minute. Al pi halacha, are you allowed to spend this money? Who does it belong to? Does it belong to you? Or perhaps it belongs to the assignment, belongs to the Arsha. Now, before anyone gets too outraged by the story, this actually never happened. But I did take the liberty, we have a number of attorneys here for the CLE. So I asked them, what would be in a court of law if this came in front of a judge? Would this be a valid gift? Would the almana be entitled to spend this money? Or would it go into the estate?
Cash.
What?
Cash.
So their advice was just keep quiet. That works in a court of law. So after a lot of hemming and hawing, and you've got to be kidding, this can't really be true, the basic consensus was that from a strict legal point of view, this would probably be part of the estate. And if there were any creditors, if there were any Yershim, they would probably be entitled to it, and she would probably not be able to buy herself something for Yontif. Now we're going to discuss today.
Legally, he gave it to her.
What?
Legally, he gave it to her.
Take that up with the attorneys.
She would be the primary Yersh.
That okay? If she's the Yersh, then good. That'll depend what it said in the will.
When did he intend for her to get?
Again, the legal aspects, you'll take it up with the attorneys afterwards, but let's discuss it from halachic point of view and go through some, we'll review some of the points we went through last week and try to determine what the halacha would be. Now, the first point that we discussed last week is that we all know there's a mitzvah of kibud av va'em. A parent has an obligation to listen to his parents. Now, based on that, if a person writes a will or writes instructions on what they want to be done with their estate, even if it's done in a way which is not technically binding, it's not, you know, from a halachic point of view or even from a legal point of view, it doesn't fit the criteria, but it clearly is an expression of what the parents want, what their wishes are. And therefore, some poskim say that, forgetting about whether it's enforceable, the mitzvah of kibud av va'em would apply, and the children would have an obligation to honor the parents' wishes. Now, as we pointed out last week, there are a number of technical problems with this. The first is that the rule is kibud av mishel av. If a father has a child, has to listen to his parents' instructions. However, if there are expenses associated with following the instructions, the parents have to pay for those expenses. They cannot force the child to spend his own money. Now, based on that, Kivegar is Meir, that when you write, if you tell your child, or if you write a tzava and tell them what to do with the estate, since by definition, the moment a person dies, his estate passes to Yerusha, it goes to the Yershim, whoever they may be. If you then tell them to go ahead and take that money, give it to your spouse, give it to daughters, give it to other people, if you're relying on the concept of kibud av, you're essentially forcing them to spend their money in order to make a mitzvah of kibud av, and that's something that they cannot be forced to do. Now, Kivegar himself points out, and there are those that argue, and they say that no. Kibud av mishel av means you can't tell a child, take money out of your pocket and go spend it for my honor. However, in this case, where the money came, Birusha, came from the parents, although in a very technical point of view, it already belongs to the children, but there are posts that suggest this is still considered mishalav. The child's not losing anything, he's just being asked to forego in the inheritance, and therefore the mitzvah of kibud av v'em would apply. But it wasn't intended to become hers right away. If he would have changed his mind, he could just put it back in his pocket. It was intended for her to find it and for her to get it only lachar misa.
A husband can't mock his wife. He can't cause a kohen for his wife.
He can't make a kinyan for himself. You cannot make a kinyan for someone else in your own assets. You can give it to a third party to be zeichen for someone else, but you cannot on your own pick something up which is yours and say, I'm now being claimed it for somebody else.
Your shal, you see, clearly we're talking about a shal, it can't be it has to be something, a person, not a thing.
Probably, although I can hear that sad, but we didn't get to, we'll get to the kind of remes a little bit later. So that's the first technical question with kibud av. The second point is that kibud av is generally when you're asking someone to feed you, to honor him, something which is directly impacts the parent. You're helping them out their physical or their physical needs. In a case, if a parent tells a child to do something, where listening or not listening has no impact on the parent. A father tells a child just, when you go to yeshiva, I want you to learn bekiyas, not be'in, or just he tells you to do something which is not directly relevant to him. So here there is a machlokes apaiskim whether mitzvah kibud avim would apply. Since the Yerusha is something which is not directly relevant to him, you're asking him to give money to someone la'achar misasai, doesn't directly impact the kavod. Here it's questionable whether there would be kibud av. Kivagar actually concludes that even if it's not kibud av, there is an isser of yira contradicting or violating his command as a chasaron in yira. If you fear someone, and if you have yira, then you don't go ahead and violate their instructions. And therefore, Kivagar is mitzadid that there would be a chiv al yira. You would have a chiv to listen. Now, regardless, this mitzvah of kibud av is something. It's a mitzvah. It's not enforceable. If you tell your child to clean his room and he refuses, you cannot send him a hasmana from a bezin. It's a mitzvah like many other mitzvahs, but it's ma'an svara b'tzidai, and it can't be enforced. And therefore, at least in the context of estate planning, if you're relying on kibud av v'em, you're essentially relying on the children voluntarily honoring your wishes. It's not something which is enforceable by a bezin. Now, another issue that we have in our particular case is that the story was a young almana. If she's a young almana, then presumably the children, at least some of the children, are below bar or bas mitzvah. A kohen or ketana do not have the chiyuv of kibud av v'em. And therefore, if the justification of listening to the instructions is kibud av, you would have to wait until the children are bar chiyuv, until the children are bar or bar mitzvah before you can ask them to go ahead and to honor the parents' wishes. Now, the second theory that you can use to uphold wills that are written, legally, but not halacha, is the concept of dina d'malchus d'dina. We know dina d'malchus d'dina, the law of the land, halacha recognizes in many instances, and therefore there are places that suggest if you write a will, you go to an attorney, you write it in a way which is consistent with local law, then it's enforceable even if it doesn't meet all the technicalities and all the criteria of halacha. Most poskim say that this is not true. Because although there's a concept of dina malchus d'dina generally means that if a country has the right to pass laws, halacha recognizes those laws, the most basic case is taxation. Every government, every king needs taxes and they need money. So if they impose a tax, it's for the benefit of the government, halacha recognizes that tax, and al-pidin, they don't have the right to collect it. But that's a case where there's a direct interest for the government. They need your money, they impose a tax, halacha says dina d'malchus d'dina. In a case where there's no direct interest, and in a case where there's just a general law, which might be the tevis ben ha-medina, it might be good for society, but there's no direct benefit to the government, here it is machlokes, whether dina d'malchus d'dina would apply. Most poskim do say dina d'malchus d'dina would apply, but again, it's somewhat questionable. But that's when the rule is a tevas b'nei ha-medina. You need traffic laws. You go open up a Shulchan Aruch, it's not going to say anywhere that you have to stop at a red light. Nevertheless, we all understand, if we don't have any traffic laws, there'll be chaos, and there's a need for such rules. It's certainly the tevas b'nei ha-medina, and therefore the concept of dina malchus d'dina would apply. However, when you're dealing with arkois, when you're dealing with just the judicial laws, the rules of the courts, there, in general, we do not say dina machusa dina. There, if we have a civil dispute between two people, so why should we go to the arkois? Why should we follow the civil law? We have our own halachas. We have the Torah, we have a Shulchan Aruch, and therefore it's not considered Tevis B'nei HaMedina to reject or to ignore halacha and follow another set of laws, and Dina Machlus Dina will not apply to matters that deal with just a civil dispute between two private Jews. Based on that, when you're dealing with a will, which is essentially just a civil contract, or it's administered by the courts, but it's something which is just an issue of our koyis, is primarily a judicial issue, there most places can say dino mechusa dino cannot work, and it cannot override halacha. If the will is not written laupi halacha, we cannot use dino mechusa dino to justify following it. Another third concept that we mentioned last week is the concept of minhog. We know that in Dine Mominus especially, Minog plays a very important role. Minog Mavatal Halacha. There's a concept of Situmta. Any action which is accepted throughout the industry as being a Kenyan, as finalizing a deal, will have the status of a Kenyan. The same way what Mazal Ubracha in the diamond industry would finalize the deal, it's a Situmta Halacha, we recognize it. So a person that writes a will, if the minhug is, if this is what everyone does, this is how to pass along your assets. So to the extent that there is a clear minhug, that everyone relies on civil wills, then the will itself could be a situmto, it could be a kinyan, because of the concept of minhug. There is extensive discussion among the paiskim. It seems that most paiskim actually say there is no such minhug, and this is going back, and these are tshuvas written, you know, over the past few hundred years. Today, the facts have probably changed. Today, I think the vast majority of Jews rely on legal wills, which means there would be a minhug. The problem that you have is that even though minhug can create a kinyan, it cannot do more than a real kinyan can do. And since the way wills are drafted, they take effect after death, the halacha is you cannot make a kinyan lachar misa. In any sort of halachic estate plan that you're going to do, the aleph beis is you have to make some sort of if you want to make a kinyan, it has to start mechayim. It has to start while your person's alive, while he still owns the assets. So therefore, if the legal will is drafted in a way where it has actually absolutely no meaning until the testator dies, at that point, according to most places, it's too late. Even though minhag can create a kinyan, the kinyan is lachar misa, and it will not help. A notable exception is the sheet of the Igros Moshe. Igros Moshe held that a minhag can create a kinyan, and he has a chiddush. There's something called a kinyan b'shas misa, and the Igros Moshe held a legal will is completely enforceable in halacha. It's a chiddush, but that is the sheet of the Igros Moshe.
So Igros Moshe would be able to overcome stand the risk of a ruach santa. In other words, you're not supposed to, to the extent that's a halachic problem. Would a person who writes the will be, and the lawyer who's writing the will, not have a problem as far as being over a ruach santa?
No, there are two separate issues. A ruach santa is an isser. That if you're going to go ahead and cut out a disinherited Yorish, that's an Isra Avurech Santa. And we discussed the parameters a few weeks ago when it will apply. What we're discussing today is the enforceability. You're only Oivra Avurech Santa if you effectively cut out the Yorish. If you're going to draft a will in a way which doesn't work in halacha, you haven't been Ma'avirach Santa because the Yorish actually belongs to him. So Adarabba, because your Moshe holds the will is effective, therefore you've helped someone violate Avurach Santa. If you are going to the Igros Moshe, if you hold that your will is a worthless piece of paper, so then it's hard to say you've over Avurach Santa because the Yorish still get it. Now you're setting someone up to Lifnei Iver, you're putting a person in a situation where the wrong person will get the assets if you take that position. But this will not change the Isser of Avurech Santa. No, it's not a Matan Mechaim. He says it's B'shas Misa. He has this new level B'shas Misa. And regardless, even Matan Mechaim, if it's done in a way, Shoach has Koitim Bisasai, there most places can say that Avurech Santa will apply. The question of Matan Mechaim is when you give it when you're younger, where it's not directly related to his death. But Shoach and Koitim Bisasai will have the regular dinim of Avurech Santa. So this is the concept of minhag. Another concept that we discussed briefly last week was the concept of a shchiv meira, a person who is deathly ill, he's very sick. So there the halacha is, divrei shchiv meira keksuvim v'chimsurim dami. Chazal relaxed the technical requirements of a kinyan, And simply by saying, by verbally giving out your assets, there the concept of shchimera, you don't need a kinyan, and the shchimera will be kiksuv mechim surum dami, and it will be binding. Normally, a shchimera has to give out all of his assets, because he has to show that he's really doesn't, you know, does not expect to survive, and that's why he's giving everything away. However, if it's a mitzvah machmas misa, if he specifically says that I'm going to die and that's why I'm giving away these assets, even if a part, even if he, anything that he gives, any sort of present, would be binding. There's another din of shchemira, which is probably daraisa of v'hayabiyoy manchilei esbanav, that you can change your yorishin. You can give one yorish more than another with a lashon yerusha. When we pass them, it applies only to a shchemira, but that's only between yorishim. To give it to another person, this second halacha will not apply. Now, going back to our story, in a case where the husband was clearly a shchemira when he wrote it, he knew he wrote it because he knew he would not survive until Pesach. So even though it's a matna shchemira b'miktzas, even though he's only giving away a small part of the estate, since it was mitzava machas misa, he wrote clearly, I'm giving this because he anticipated not surviving, this would arguably be a matna shchemira, which would not need a kinyan. It would be considered a matana, it would work, even though the kinyan was not done. It may depend on the language of the note. That's, you know, we're not going to go into technicalities, but there's a reasonably good chance that it would be a matna shchemira.
Why don't you have the problem that you didn't give all those assets away?
Because that rule of shchemira is only when you just give a matana. So although the person is very sick, the fact that he gave him a matana, we don't know for sure that he's giving it because he expects to die, and the din of shchemira will not apply. If you specifically say, I'm being mitzava machmas misa, he's sick and he says, I'm giving this away because I'm afraid I will not survive, that's mitzava machmas misa, and there, even if you only give a portion of the estate, there the regular din of matna shchemira would apply.
So a will is not a
matna. Well, it depends. If a will is written, if a person waits until he's dying to write a will, and he gives away all of his assets, in theory that would be a matna shchemira, and that would work even without a kinyan. The problem with relying on that is, number one, most people write wills when they're younger, before they're a shchemira. And number two, even by a matna shchemira, matna shchemira applies when you give a verbal instructions. You tell the person, this is how I want to distribute the estate. So because he's on his deathbed, if we would start making the kinyanim, doing shira hagbah, bringing the rav, the dayan, so who knows what will happen. So we say, whatever verbal commands he gives, that's enough. If he attempts to make a kinyan, but he does it wrong, this rule doesn't apply. This, the whole point here is to make it easy for him. Don't worry about kinyanim, just tell me what you want. But if he says, no, I want to do a kinyan, and starts making kinyanim, he does it in a way where it won't work, that's worse, and there you do not have the din of divrei shchemira. So a person who is a shchemira writes a will, but he thinks the will is a good kinyan. If it isn't, besides the fact there's no kinyan, you also don't have the rule of matna shchemira. Now the last concept that I'd like to go through is the concept of mitzvah kaim divrei ames. There is a halacha, there is a mitzvah kind of a base, there is a mitzvah to live. A person gives instructions what he wants to be done with his money and then he dies. There is a mitzvah to listen to what he says. Now, this mitzvah is enforceable. In contrast to kibud av, which we said is a mitzvah, but you can't, Beis Din will not step in, it's his personal obligation. Over here, mitzvah kind of a base is something which Beis Din will force the Yarshim to honor the mitzvah. However, there's a machlokes rishonim, but mitzvah kinyan divrei ames does not apply in all cases. There are gemaras which it's clear, and the gemaras looking for ways how to transfer something, and it's clear that mitzvah kinyan divrei ames was not an option. So what many places can say, and this seems to be the achra of Shulchan Aruch, is that mitzvah kinyan divrei ames applies only when it's hushush lekach. You have to, at the time you give the instructions what you want done, you have to take the assets, give it to a trustee, give it to someone in escrow, and say, here, take this money. After I die, this is what I want you to do with it. Since it was hushush lekach, since you transferred it to a third party with the specific instructions, there, mitzvah kinyan divrei ames will apply. However, if you do not transfer it to a third party, or if it's there by a third party for some other reason, there, Shulchan Aruch seems to paskin, mitzvah kinyan divrei ames will not apply. Now, based on this, there's a Noi de Bihudo that has a story. A person before he died, he had a brother who he was partners with. They were very close. It was a very close mishpacha, and there was some pressure in the family to have the shidduch between his son and his brother's daughter. So it was always back and forth. He always resisted it, On his deathbed, he calls in his wife and he says, I'm about to die. I know after I die, the shachan's going to call again. Whatever you do, don't let them get married. So the issue was, is there a mitzvah kind of Rameis? So another people says no. He says, first of all, even Mechayim, you don't have the right, you can't pick and choose who your children are going to marry. So he says, it's not really minyan. He said, but then he says, even if you would say there's mitzvah kind of Rameis, but you need hushush l'kach. You have to give it over to an escrow signed by a third party. If you'd give your daughter over to a third party, I don't know how you put a daughter into escrow, but in the absence of that, it says clearly there's no mitzvah l'kayim d'vrei hameis according to the Pesukim. Now, based on this, what happens if a person opens a bank account? He deposits money in the account, and at the time he opens the account, he designates who the beneficiary should be, who should receive these funds if he dies. So here it's hushlish. Here it's in the hands of a third party. And at the time you put them, at least at the time when you open the account, you're specifying what should happen to the money. So here it would seem like you have a mitzvah mekayim d'vrei hameis. However, there's another Mordechai which creates a problem, because Mordechai writes that what you need is, the point over here is that this shows that you're serious. You, at the time you gave the instructions, it wasn't just talk. You gave the money to a third party with a specific intent, or with the instruction that the reason why you gave it to the third party was in order that your wishes should be carried out. On the other hand, if they're by a third party for another reason, Stam, you have a partner, he's holding on to money for you, you have someone who's wife, and you mentioned to him, by the way, this is what I want to be done with the money. It was not hushish l'kach. There the Mordechai says, if that's not the ikar kavano, there you will not have mislo kaim devrei hameis. If a person opens a bank account, and the primary intent of giving it to the bank is because he's earning his interest, or because he needs the convenience of a checking account, and because he doesn't want to keep the money under his mattress. And by the way, they tell him, once you're doing this, you may as well have a designated beneficiary. There, according to this Mordechai, it's not so pashut that mislo kaim devrei hameis would apply. A case where it would apply is if a person creates a trust and he gives the money to an independent trustee. So at that point, even if the trust is revocable, he has the right to pull it back whenever he wants. But mitzvah l'kayim d'vrei hameis would apply. The assets were transferred into the control of a third party. It was at the time that it was transferred, it was with the specific instructions what should be done l'achar misa. The whole purpose of the trust was for estate planning. So in that case, that would clearly be a mitzvah l'kayim d'vrei hameis. Now, if the trust was for other reasons, it was for Medicaid or some other sort of, and this is just an added benefit, then we would have this question about the Mordechai. But when there is a trust, and there's a third-party trustee, and that's the whole point of the trust in order to do the estate planning, mitzvah l'kayim d'vrei hameis would apply.
Well, what's it mean under halacha to have a trust? Like, if I have a bank account, say it has at the end of the days, is $100,000. Can I have two witnesses here now and say, listen, this money, $20,000, is under trust. It's going to stay in this account, but it's under trust, $20,000. You two witnesses say that, and I don't, on paper, it's not anywhere, but these two witnesses...
The requirement that you have in halacha is to physically hand over the asset to a third party. Now, if you sign legal documents that give them de facto control, so there's an igros moshe in chesh mishpat beis min beis that says giving them the papers, the documents that they need, that they have control, that's sufficient. If you just say it and it doesn't mean it, that now the trustee doesn't have any control, can't do anything with it, then that's not going to have any effect in halacha. Okay, we have a lot to cover. I'll take questions at the end. So this is the shita. This is the pashas shita in Shulchan Aruch. There are other rishonim that argue. There are other rishonim that say you do not actually need a hushash l'kach. You don't have to transfer ownership. But they say as long as you give these instructions directly to the yorish, or to the person who has control of the assets, that is sufficient. Which means if you call in your children and say, this is what I want you to do, l'achar misasi, according to these rishonim, that would be enough to create a mitzvah l'kayim d'vrei hameis. It's a machlokes apaiskim. What we hold like, it's not very clear. The Ramon, the Mechaber sound like you need hushul tekach. The Sman, the Shach hold that instructions are enough. For Kiveger and Shul Sakhar Metmiyah, there's a whole. It's machlokes apaiskim. It's not very clear what the bottom line halacha would be. Now, where does that leave us as far as a legal will? We mentioned before, a legal will is not written as a kinyan. If it is a kinyan, it's a kinyan lachamusa, and it's not going. It will not help. Mine shchivera is not going to help us because wills are usually written while the person is alive and well, and he's not a shchivera. What about mislo kaim d'vrei hameis? So bishleim, if you set up a trust, and you transfer the assets to an independent trustee. So there we would have a mitzvah kaim divrei hames. But in the absence of that, when you have a will, even though you have an executor, the executor is really nothing until after the person dies. But mechaim, it's nothing. There was no transfer that took place. And therefore, from a technical point of view, mitzvah kaim divrei hames should not apply. Besides this technical issue, you have another problem. That mitzvah kaim divrei hames is when you give instructions. A will is usually not instructions to the Yerush. A will is essentially, an attempt to make a kinyan. And yesh lodoy mechla, whether mitzvah kaim divrei hames is shayach to this. Nevertheless, the Achiezer and the Minchas Shai have a tremendous chiddush, and they say like this. They say that a legal will have mitzvah kaim divrei hames. It will be enforceable, even though it doesn't meet any of these requirements. Why? Because they say, let's go back for a minute. When mitzvah kaim divrei hames is that whenever you give a person gives instructions and he dies, there's a mitzvah to listen to these instructions. Why do you have to give it to a third party? What's this requirement of an escrow and hushush lukach? So they say the reason for it is because talk is cheap. The fact that you say this is what I want to happen, okay, you said it, you meant it, you didn't mean it. We're not going to go ahead and change any halachos or do anything based on your this verbal expression of your wishes. Masha'enkein, if at the time you say it, you take the asset, you give it to a third party, and say, listen, this is what I want you to do, lachar misasi, that shows you're very serious, and this really reflects what you want and what you expect to happen. Zok de Achiezer, the person executes a legal document, where at the end of the day, bottom line is, he knows, when he dies, this is what's going to court, this is what the judge is going to see. And this is what he's going to force to happen. It's very clear that your person is dead serious that this is what he wants, this is what he expects to happen, this is not just talk. And therefore, the Achiezer's Mechadish, even though it doesn't meet the technical requirements in Shulchan Aruch of Hushish Lekach, because it's clear that he's serious, because it's clear that that is his intent, the concept of Mitzvah Kayim Dibri Hameis would apply.
Is that clear that Hushlos Kafis is the Batara of that is the Figmaris Das?
It's not clear, but this is the Achiezer. There are some Mashmois in some of the Achreinim like that, but there's no real discussion what the reason is. So it's hard. So this is the Achiezer's Chiddush. The Achiezer doesn't say Batara's Vadai, but this is the Achiezer's Chiddush. Now, interestingly enough, Rav Yashiv had an interesting Pshara. He says it depends who wrote the will. He says if the person who wrote the will is not Dati, he's not from. As far as he's concerned, everything goes by the courts. So then, when he wrote in the will, this is what I want to happen, he was clearly saying Mechdas, he expected this. He expected that his wishes would be fulfilled. And there he's mitzadid to say that perhaps you can be samech on the Achiezer. So Mashiachim, the person's from. He knows his halacha, he knows his choshen mishpat, he knows his concept of bezdin, so he may have been too lazy to look into it or to go ahead and write a halachic will, but there he says you cannot say the mitzvah kind of ramez, you can't say this gemir is das, and he says you cannot rely on a legal will. Now this mistama is in Eretz Yisrael. In Eretz Yisrael, I guess most people write halachic wills. In Chutz Laaretz, where the vast majority of people rely on civil wills, and it seems from the Truvas this has been going on for quite some time, you know, it's hard to say this chiluk. I think today in the United States, people who write wills, if you would ask them, do you expect this to be honored or not, or do you expect your yershin to schlep you to Bezdin, schlep the sisters to Bezdin and go through, I think most people think that it will be honored. And therefore, at least we have what to be said. We have this Achiezer that Mitzvah Kaim Divrei Hameis would apply to any civil will. Now, as far as halacha l'maaseh, what comes out is like this. If a person dies without any will or trust whatsoever, so there, all Paiskim agree, we do not say Dina Mechusa Dina. And in such a case, if the daughters or people who take money that they're legally entitled to, that Al Pi Halacha they're not entitled to, all the Paiskim agree that that would be straight out Gezel. And if a person needs another incentive to do some estate planning, it's to avoid this kind of situation, where the courts will distribute the assets one way, which Al Pi Halacha would be Aser. There, as we mentioned, if the courts require the daughters or the wife to sign a waiver, they perhaps don't have to. They can negotiate. They can demand a share of the Yerusha before they sign it. That was a discussion we discussed a few weeks ago. But bottom line is, if the people who are not Yerushim take assets, that is straight gzela. Mashiach, if a person writes a will, so we have a bunch of sudden to be mekayim it. Because Moshe holds the kinyan. There's nothing to talk about. It's perfectly enforceable in halacha. Forget about all of the details. If it's enforceable legally, as Moshe says, it's a kinyan, b'shas misa, it will work. Even if you want to argue on the Gris Moshe, we have the Achiezer that says it would be mitzvah l'kayim divrei emes. Even though it's not hushash l'kach, if it's something which people are samech on, the Achiezer, the Mepeshai, the Meran Padova, and the Sribo Yashav also sounds like they all say you can rely on mitzvah l'kayim divrei emes. Even without mitzvah l'kayim divrei emes, if we're dealing with a parent, there's a mitzvah of kibbutz. And while it's not enforceable, and there may be technical issues, all the places agree, if you want to know what the right thing to do is, the right thing to do is to listen to, is to honor the wishes and to follow what it says in the will. So if a person dies and he has a will, certainly if a Yoyrish wants to know what he should do, certainly what he should do is he should honor the will. If he refuses to and it goes to Beis Din, so then the Beis Din is going to have to make achra. Are they going to be samech on this Igros Moshe and this Achiezer or not? Now, it's very unlikely for them to just throw out the will, because there are many tzadim, and the minhag seems to be to follow a will. But there's no guarantee it will be niskayim completely, and therefore it's certainly kedai to do a shtar chatzizaka, or to do something to make sure that it's enforceable l'kulayama. Now, if a person dies with a will, and the yorishim on their own follow the will, the Maran Padova says, as a dover pasha, you don't have to go ahead and tell them. You should know, by the way, you can really go to Beis Din. Maybe you don't owe me the money. Maybe you can keep it. You can be samech on these shitas. You can be samech on the fact that children want to do what their parents say, and you can take the money. You don't have to go ahead and start making problems. But if a Yoyrish does make problems and does want to go to Beis Din, so it's not completely clear what will happen. Certainly, if there are any other problems with the will or any other svekos, then this whole issue will come back to haunt you. Because since a will itself is questionable, we have all this back and forth. Even if a Beis Din would rely on it in the absence of any other problems, if there is a problem, then this tziruf will come back, and therefore it's certainly kedai to do some sort of shtar chatzizaka, which we'll go through in a minute. Now, just to briefly, we discussed wills. Trusts, I just want to go through briefly some of the different trusts. We're not going to go through all the details. I'm sure the attorneys have it really depends on the case. But basically, if a person sets up a revocable trust, where he himself is a trustee, so then al pi halacha, it probably is the same thing as a will. Nothing happened, nothing really the assets didn't change hands. It's just a document that is enforceable in court. So if you follow enforceable documents based on the Achiezer or the Gris Moshe, so then this would also be binding. So it would have the same effect as a will. If a revocable trust, which you're giving the assets to an independent trustee, there already you would have mitzvah kind of remes according to all shittas, because you actually transfer the assets to a third party. The fact that you can revoke it, you can take it back, is not a problem. Every mitzvah kind of remes, you can change your mind while you're still alive, and therefore that would be enforceable about mitzvah kind of remes.
Where it's co-trustee.
Where it's both? I don't know. Now, if you have an irrevocable trust should be even better, because it's given over to a third, it's transferred to a third party, and there certainly should be a mitzvah kind of remes. Arguably, it's not even a question of divrei emes anymore. Arguably, by an irrevocable trust, once you've given it away, it's no longer yours. Your death doesn't change anything. If you've relinquished all your legal rights the moment you gave it away, it is mistama imatana mechayim, and therefore it shouldn't even go into chazirusha, it shouldn't even go into mitzvah kayim divrei emes. What? Good. So however you transferred into a trust, whatever shtar or whatever kinyan you did, so there, that transfer is very likely a kinyan. Now, that kinyan itself may not, metalkalin doesn't work with shtar, but if it's a shtar, it'll work for karka, and it'll probably be a situmta, because that's, however you transfer assets legally, that probably would be a situmta, and it's mechayim. You don't run into the problems of la'achar misa.
Even for stuff that's coming in the future,
if income that the trust earns belongs to the trust it belongs to the trust already. Income that you earn in the future, you're going to have to deposit it into the trust, and that deposit will be a transfer. And at that point, you'll have your kingdom. Now, one thing which, when you're dealing with an irrevocable trust, there is a question of who actually owns the assets in a trust. Now, there are three people. There's a settlor, there's a person who funds the trust, there's a trustee, and then there are the beneficiaries. Now, the settlor, once he puts the money in, legally he's out. He's gone. He has nothing to do with it. It's not his anymore. The beneficiaries don't really have any ownership until it's actually distributed. Elamai is the trustee. So does that mean that the trustee actually owns the money in the trust? So I'll tell you, there was a Maisa Shalya. There was this is a person called a Rav, where there was a person who funded a trust. It was irrevocable. Now, coincidentally, someone else had also funded a trust. Again, no relation, no connection between the two. But they used the same trustee. Now, at one point, one of the trusts needed money. And this attorney, the trustee, suggested, you know what, I'm a trustee in another trust. Let me see if I can set up a deal where your trust will borrow from his trust. You'll pay him interest. Everyone will be happy. So, that's what they did. But before they closed the deal, they realized, this is a problem of rivas. One trust is paying the other trust interest. So they went to ask a shayla, how do you write ahead to Iska for a trust? So they got back an incredible psak. The psak they got back was that no, that the trustee that the money in the trust is owned by the trustee. And therefore, if you have the same trustee for two different trusts, even though two different beneficiaries and two different grantors, there's no issue paying yourself interest. And therefore, there's Rav Paskin that there's no issa ribis if it's the same trustee because it's his money. That was interesting.
The trustee only has bare legal title. He doesn't have anything.
Correct. I'm not taking a credit for this time. I'm just telling you over a story. That was interesting is, wait, two point. What?
If he takes the money for himself,
that's true. That's true. He definitely is not allowed to use it. The equitable title might be by the beneficiaries, but it's not theirs yet. In halacha, it's probably like a kinyan amanas lahakanus. If I give it to you, you can just hold it, and then later you give it to someone else. Until you give it to someone else, right now it's yours. So you may be limited in the use and the benefit, but if you want to know right now who owns it, that was the psak. It was interesting, last year, it was actually exactly a year ago, I got a phone call from one of the people who funded one of the trusts, and he wanted to know, does he have to check his office? Does he have to do b'dikas chametz? I said, yeah, this is mefurash. You have to check your house. If you have your own office, you have to do b'dikas chametz. This is a very, very large office. He said, no, I hold I don't have to. Why? Because the office is in the trust. So it's not my office, it's the trustee's office. Let him go around and to check everyone's chametz. Now, the problem with me relying on this approach, besides for the chiddush and lomdus and how to look at it, there's another basic problem maybe the lawyers shouldn't be listening to this, but that is, it's very nice on paper when you set up an irrevocable trust, it's not yours anymore, it's gone, everything's an arm's length transaction, you have no control over it. But the reality is, in many cases, there is sort of an understanding between the parties that the trustee, the person who put the money in the trust has complete and total control. To whatever extent he can possibly manage, he can do what he wants. And the trustee is really, very often, it's some sort of a harama, and he's really acting on behalf of the person who put the money in the trust. And actually, in the same case, with this fellow who was saying everything's in a trust, it's not his, he doesn't have a check for chametz, the fellow was worth, a few $100 million. I asked him if I can be Makayim Mitzvah Matanos Levyonim by giving him money next year. Because he's penniless. His trust is... So at that point, he was Moedah, he doesn't look at himself as an Ani. He does look at it as it is. So it's very difficult, befrat by Nisus D'oraisa, to rely on the technicalities if under the table there's an understanding it still belongs to him. So again, it'd be very difficult to say. But once we say this, once we're going to be choishish, this is a harama, and it's really his, then it goes back into our Yerusha problem. And therefore, when you're doing your estate planning, you should take this into account, and you should include the trust in the Shtar HaTzizachar just to avoid these questions of harama. Okay, we're running out of time, but I want to very briefly go through what a Shtar HaTzizachar is. We spent all this time working up to how to do halachic estate planning, so let's briefly discuss how it's actually done. Now, as we mentioned, the simplest way to do things is simply to make a kenyan. Give everything out mechayim, either an outright gift or a guf meayom peres lachamisa. It's very often not practical. It will not work on money that you get in the future. It will not work if there are changes in the beneficiaries. So there's no direct way to really transfer assets. So what's done is a bit of a trick. Let's say a person wants his daughters to yarshin him. Now, a daughter is not a yarish. So what people do is the following. They write a shtar chayv. They write that I am obligated to my daughter $10 million. Now, if at that point he would die, so the yarshim, who would yarshim his estate? His sons, they're the yarshim. But along with the assets come the liabilities. They would yashin all of the estate, but they'd owe their sister $10 million. Now, it's very nice. This is a good way to get the daughter's money, but the problem is you don't want to give them everything. You only want to give them a portion of the estate. So what you do is like this. When you write this debt, I owe my daughter $10 million, you make a tanai, and you write that this debt is conditional. It only kicks in if the yarshim refuse to honor my will or my instructions. If they honor the instructions, they give you the share of Yerusha that it says in this legal document, then this debt is null and void. So what happens is the person dies, the sons, the yarshim, have a choice. If they want to go to Bez and say, listen, I'm the yarshim, it all belongs to me, good, so they're entitled to do that al pi halacha. But then this $10 million debt to their sister kicks in. At that point, they would have to take the entire estate and give it to their sister as what? No, the debt is the debt starts immediately. It's payable a moment before death, but it's al tanai. You can have a tanai that's conditioned on actions that happen later, but the debt itself starts immediately. So essentially, what you're doing is this does not change the seder ha-yerusha. It's a way to force the sons, the yarshim, to voluntarily listen to what you have to say. So in other words, there's a chayiv, you have this debt, but it's conditioned on them. So if they listen to what it says in the will, they give the daughters, the spouse, whatever it is, they follow all of your wishes, this debt is null and void. If they don't listen, if they want to go ahead and claim that they're the Yerush, they get everything, then they get stuck with this huge debt, which will wipe them out.
Does that work for Bishnaim too?
Yeah, you can do this for everything. You can do this for everything. Now, typically what that means is, what a person will do is, when a person wants to do his estate planning, so the first thing to do is to decide where you want to distribute your assets. So we discussed the Isra Avu Reach Santa, we discussed the wife is entitled to a ksuba, to support. You figure out what you want. Once you know what you want, the next step to do is to go to an attorney, have a will, a trust, something that's done that will hold up in our case, because the bottom line is it will go through probate, it will go through administrative. You have to make sure that everyone is legally protected, that you have something which will hold up in court. After that, you add this Shtar Chatzi Zachar. What you do is you figure out, who are you giving money to that al pi halacha is not entitled to it? And the typical cases would be daughters, tzedakah, and again, a spouse will depend. It's only if you're giving above the ksuva, which is not so common, but it does happen. Whoever those people are who are getting something which al pi halacha they would not get in the absence of a will, there you write a shtar chatzi zachar to them, you create this debt. The debt has to be obviously larger than the benefit they'll get under the will. So under the will, they're supposed to get $50,000. You write a $100,000 debt. And that way, the yarshim, the sons, have an incentive to honor the will and not to make problems. Now, if a person changes his will, he does not have to redo the shtar chatzi zachar. Because as long as the beneficiaries are the same, once you're writing that I owe $10 million to my daughter, but if the sons honor my last will or my last trust, then it's null and void. You change your will and trust as many times as you want. The bottom line is the Shtar Chatzi Zachar will remain the same, unless, again, if you have another daughter or you want to change your beneficiaries, then you may have to redo it. Otherwise, you don't have to. Now, when a person writes a Shtar Chatzi Zachar, a few quick tips. First of all, it's important to have Edom there. Try to make sure the Edom are not related to you, not related to any of the beneficiaries. Otherwise, they're Pasul Edus. It's also a good idea to make sure they're younger than you, because they're going to be needed.
Why do you need Edom?
Because if your daughter pulls out this document and can't prove that you actually signed it, it's not going to be enforceable. Now, they could do a din min chasimus. The Bezin can start comparing signatures, but that's much more difficult. You're better off having two Edom that can be made. It was in front of us. He signed it, and it was for real. Now,
it wouldn't be common for the son to be my witnesses in front of his face.
It's common, but the idea of this is, like all the attorneys will tell you, that you want to protect yourself for the uncommon cases as well. If your children are going to listen to it without it, we're not going to contest it, then you may not need this at all. It's not really going to help. I mean, you can't be mechayev a shvua. It's not. It's you should have two. You should have two aidim. Again, it is like saviyad. So paraiti usually is not a tain if they don't know about it. So technically, saviyad will be enough if you can prove that it's really his signature. But it's kedai to get the second.
But would it be enough for the daughters to say, "I'm similar to the saviyad, and if I want, I'll follow with the akosay"? Would it be enough for the daughter?
Well, the daughters, if there is a legal will, the daughters, they want to rely on Achiezer, they could. The problem is if she gets slept to a Bezdin and the sons say, we don't follow that, then whatever his pikukim are, then you'll have a problem. So it's kedai to have to weigh them. Then they don't count. They don't count. There is a din of arkois if you have a document that's notarized in a formal court. So they're going. That goes back to the discussion of dina machusadina. There are many cases where we will rely on goyish witnesses when it's done in the context of a court where it's known they don't take bribes. But that's again, if you go to court and get it validated or recorded, then you may be able to rely on witnesses that are not Jewish. But stam a notary that happens in someone's office, it's good to get Jewish witnesses.
The attorney stam of rechus, which is designed to defraud yorshim, isn't this an illegitimate? No real value.
Correct, but it's like this. Legally, if this document gets brought to court, in all likelihood it'll get left out of court. There's no consideration. This is harama. That's fine. You don't want this to be brought in court. Actually, in the Shtar Chatzizacha that I write, it says specifically it's not intended to be enforced in court because that's not what it's there for. It's there for in halacha, and in halacha you don't need consideration. If I make a kinyan, if I say I want to owe you $10 million, and I would make a kinyan, I now owe you that money, regardless of whether there was any consideration or whether I ever borrowed money from you. The person has that right to create a debt, and over here, his intent is to create the debt because he wants to force his yarshim to honor his wishes.
Do you need a separate kinyan with the shtar chatzizacha?
In theory, the shtar itself could be a kinyan. When you're using the shtar as a kinyan, you have to hand it to a third party. Just signing it yourself and holding on to it is not enough. It's kedai. You generally do a kinyan sudder at the same time. It's just better. It works for metal. It's kedai to make a kinyan sudder.
Who holds that stuff?
Generally, give it to the. Make sure it's generally kedai to have a copy by the attorney, whoever's going to have the will, to make sure that the daughter or the beneficiaries will actually know where it is.
The
attorney could, yeah.
It doesn't have to be legally binding. They challenge. They go into court to challenge.
Exactly, that's the whole point. You're relying, for as far as legally, you're relying on the lawyer to take care of your will and your trust. The idea of this document is just if you end up in Bezdin, and the Bezdin will not, if they will not go with the will. So now this is going to, so that's why this document does not need to be enforced in court, and I doubt it is. Again, speak to your attorneys, but I would imagine it doesn't have much legal force. Okay, just want to end off briefly with there's a chinuch that really just explains the whole concept of Yerusha. It says, what's Pshan Yerusha? Why do things go be Yerusha? Why do things pass in to a person's family? So he explains that when a Kadosh Baruch Hu gives a matana, when a Kadosh Baruch Hu does a toiva to anyone, Kadosh Baruch Hu's toiva is nitzvias. It lasts forever. And really, a person, Adam Rishon Kodem Achetz, wasn't supposed to die. And anything that Kodesh Baruch Hu gave him the whole world, it was supposed to be his loyal and loyal. What happened? People, Adam Rishon ate from the Eitz Hadas. People do Averis. And because of their Averis, it's going nigzar on them that they die. And they're no longer able to benefit, get the full hana from the Toivah, from the Baruch that Kodesh Baruch Hu gave them. Zok the Chinuch, the fact that a person is no longer there, that doesn't take away from the Hatava of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And therefore, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives a Matana, it's supposed to stay with the person Lo Elam Vayed. And if he's no longer there, his children, where we know Brok Kairo Do'avua, the children take the place of the parents, so they're there to be nana from it, to benefit from it, because of that original Hatava, which is supposed to last forever. Person dies without children, Chinuch explains the reason why it goes to his family is because when a person was zeicha to wealth, it's probably because of the mitzvahs that he did, because of his actions. When a person does mitzvahs, it's generally his family that's responsible for his chinuch, it's generally his family that inspired him and molded him and caused him and was the cause of doing this mitzvahs that he was zeicha in the wealth. And therefore, it makes sense that they're the ones, if in the absence of children, they're the ones that should receive the Yerusha, they're the ones that should see that should be Yerush that bracha. Now, what that means is that the Yerusha of Mamet is the Yerusha that a person has, the Yerusha of a person's wealth, is really following the Messiah. Because a child is the Mamal HaMakom, because he continues on the mission, he was shaped by the parents. That's why he gets the financial Yerusha. And we explained a number of times that Al Pi Halacha, a son is Yerush, not a daughter. According to this chinuch, I think it's a very, very beautiful explanation. The Messiah that in Klal Yisrael is from father to son. If you want to know if someone's Jewish or not, you look at the mother. But if you want to know what shevet he's from, you look at the father. Now we know each shevet has its different unique mission, unique aspect of Avodas Hashem. You have Koyanim, you have Malchus, you have Yisachar, you have Zevulun. That's something which goes by a father. Minhagim are handed down from father to son. So if the point of Yerusha is that the father, the child is a Mamal Makam of the father, so then it makes perfect sense that the son, who is the one that carries on the father's mission, that carries on the father's Messiah, is the one that is Yerusha. Now I think this message is very appropriate for this time of year. We know at the Lel Seder, there's a chiyuv of the guy to Levincha. We know one of the basic mitzvahs of Klal Yisrael is Emunah Yetzias Mitzrayim. And it's something that's passed down every year from father to son at the Haggadah, the Manashtana, the mitzvah of the Yad to Levincha. Now you would think that it's such an important mitzvah. What we would do is every year, Pesach time, we'd get the biggest Talmud Chacham, the most inspiring orator, and let him go and give a gewaldig shmooze about Yetzias Mitzrayim. But that's not how it's done. Yetzias Mitzrayim is handed, and the Emunah is something which is, has to be handed down within each family. Each family is different. They have their own Messiah. They have their own way of explaining things. They have their own Messiah that's passed from father to son. And that's why the Chiyuv is Vigat Levincha. Each family has their own Karban Pesach. Each family has their own obligation, their own Chiyuv to pass it from father to son. So this is just another example of how the Yerusha, the Messiah, passes from one generation to the next, from father to son. So what comes out is that really these two concepts are related. The Yerusha of Mominus, Yerusha of accumulated wealth, is really there to reflect the Yerusha of the Messiah. The fact that each family has its own Messiah, has its own Milo and Taklis in Avodas Hashem. And therefore, when we're learning Hilchos Yerusha, when a person's sitting down to do estate planning, on one hand, we mentioned that it's a depressing topic. People don't like doing estate planning. They don't like thinking about their death. But on the other hand, if you think about it, it really, really brings out how much bracha a person has. The fact that a person, number one, has the wealth to pass on to the next generation, the fact that he has children, that he has mishpacha to whom to pass it over, that itself is a tremendous bracha. And the same way we have to realize, the same way it's a bracha in Gashmias, it's that same bracha in Ruchnius, the chiyuv of the God of Levincha, the chiyuv of the Messiah from father to son. So Yirotzen, we should all be zeicha to pass along our brachas, both in Gashmias and both in Ruchnius, to the next generation. We should all be mekayim the mitzvah of the God of Levincha and have a chag kosher v'sameach. Now, if there's anyone on the email list, we'll be sending out a kuntres on Hilchos Yerusha. If anyone's not on the email list, just please give your email address to Aaron Tuber.